The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Tonight, I'm pleased to welcome two young and very talented artists who offer new perspectives on the immigrant's tale, a tale where the destination continues to be as fraught as the journey. Our first presenter, Lila Corman, has created a graphic novel that tells the story of twin sisters whose lives take very different trajectories as they try to create themselves in opposition to the patriarchal plexus of early 20th century mores on the Lower East Side. Corman's Unterzaken continues the dialogue begun by such predecessors as Will Eisner in A Contract with God and Anzia Yasherska's Breadgivers, whose young female protagonist throws off the shackles of a suffocating rabbi father to seek a room of her own. As one review said, Corman gracefully traces both young women's efforts to maintain control of their bodies in an unpredictable and at times violent world. She steeps her striking black and white artwork with period details. The story of Fania and Esther's struggle is beautifully drawn and hard to forget. Corman is the author and illustrator of the 2002 graphic novel Subway series and a contributor to many publications, including Bust Magazine and the New York Times. Our second presenter, David Besmosges, was last here in 2004 for his award-winning collection, Natasha and Other Stories. He joins us tonight to present The Free World, the story of three generations of the Krasnaski family as they travel from Latvia to Austria to Rome, where they get caught up in the chaos of emigre culture and yet can't help but be themselves in the new world. A critic for the New York Times opines, from the start, Besmosges overturns cliched expectations of immigrant idealism. He knows his characters too well to have any illusions about them, but he laces even his darkest humor with pathos. While his depictions don't flatter his subjects, they honor them by conveying each person's individual history, motivations, and truth. I think that last sentence also applies to our first presenter's work. Please welcome Lila Corman.
Thank you. So the way that I usually do my presentation is I give you a little educational slideshow and then read you a little excerpt from my book. And then I take questions, but I don't know if that's something that you want me to do here. So I'll take my cues from you. At the end? Okay. Thank you. So does anybody know what the title of my book means? Can anyone pronounce it? I heard one or two good Galiciano pronunciations out there. That's okay. I don't expect anybody to pronounce it. It's a trick question. There's actually no vowel between the K and the N. So I had the idea for this book I like to say that it came as a flash, like a lightning bolt, and the whole structure kind of revealed itself to me, the basic structure revealed itself to me pretty quickly. It actually was a bit of an outgrowth of a much older idea that wasn't going anywhere, which I think is an interesting thing that happens when you're writing a story. Sometimes you keep hammering away at something, and it just keeps not working, and then all of a sudden a detour suggests itself rather violently, meaning it yanks you onto the path, something completely different. So I was sitting in the auditorium of the West Side Y on 63rd Street in Manhattan, where coincidentally I'd gone to camp as a kid, and waiting for a Kim Deitch lecture to begin. Kim Deitch is a really great, one of the underground's greatest cartoonists. And Fania appeared on a napkin with a pillow under her dress saying, ugh. I don't know where the napkin went, so you guys will have to be content with this image, which comes from the book. And as soon as Fania appeared, I knew that she had a twin sister named Esther. I knew that their mother ran a corset shop, and I knew that their father didn't talk. I knew that Fania was going to be the apprentice to the neighborhood abortionist slash midwife, and I knew that Esther was going to be a showgirl. At the time, I was also very inspired by Margaret Sanger's work. She, coincidentally or not, got her start on the Lower East Side as a visiting nurse, and it was one of the things that propelled her to do her advocacy for birth control and family planning. And I'm always inspired by old showgirl costumes because those are just the greatest. I especially like this image, even though it didn't really make it into the book exactly, because it's a fake pharaonic vaudeville act. Those are still being done today here and in Egypt. And then suddenly this lady on the left appeared in my sketchbook, Miss Lucille. Now, if you've been in any performance discipline, like dance especially, you have met this woman. A friend of mine called it aging stripper syndrome. This is that lady who never lets you forget that she was really big once, really popular once in the past. So I thought it would be fun to caricature that type of person, but I'm not a caricaturist, so she came across as hopefully a little more than just a caricature. And you can probably tell I'm related to those two people on the left. That's my grandfather and my grandmother right after World War II. Those are their passport photographs after they got out of the DP camp when they went to France. So a lot of people have asked me if this book is autobiographical. It's not. I don't do autobiography. But there's a little sliver of real life that makes it into the beginning of the fiction process. I guess it's like a splinter, right? And then the story grows around that. The character of Isaac in the book, the girl's father, was tiny, tiny bit inspired by my grandfather. I decided to take a little bit of his, tiny bit of his life and a lot of his hair and his eyes and give them to Isaac. But Isaac is entirely fictional, and I hasten to add that my grandfather's life was nothing like Isaac's at all. I started out drawing mini comics. I don't know if there's any other cartoonists here. If there are, you probably started out drawing mini comics too. It was a reaction in part to going to art school and realizing that I didn't want to be in the art world, even though I wanted to be an artist for a living. I wanted to do something that was more democratic. I wanted to make art that was accessible, that people could buy very cheaply and stick in their back pocket and take wherever they wanted, and something that could be mass-produced for that purpose. I'd always wanted to draw comics, and then when I finally allowed myself to start, it was only after I saw other people's work, other people's originals, that I saw, oh, well, you know, I could do this too. So these are some pages from my art school era mini comics, where I was mostly concerned with principles of design. I'm sorry that I don't have better images of these. And then I did this book called Queen's Day in 1999. That was my senior illustration project and my Xeric grant application. If you're in the comics world, you've heard of the Xeric grant also. They just stopped doing it this year, I think. But it was a really great grant that was given to young cartoonists to self-publish a book, and it was founded by one of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle guys. So one of the Mutant Ninja Turtle guys bought the Batmobile and married a porn star, and the other one started the Xeric Foundation and gave money to cartoonists. So I was also, I was still already kind of working with material from my grandparents' world. My grandmother used to not exactly tell the story of the Baba Yaga to me. She'd kind of just invoke the Baba Yaga. The Baba Yaga eats children who don't go to sleep. If you don't move away from the vacuum cleaner, the Baba Yaga will eat you. So I thought I would tell a story about a Baba Yaga who's a vegetarian and kindly to children. And then I did this book called Subway Series. When I moved back to New York City, I guess I wanted to tell a story set in New York. I had decided that I was sick of drawing not experimental, that's the wrong word. I'm a little tired. I was tired of drawing representational art in my comics, and I wanted to strip down my cartooning style I had gone to France and I had seen all of these really beautiful, simple comics. And I wanted to try it, but I could never get my comics to look like that because nobody draws like the French. So I played around with just breaking my style down to something very minimalist, and ultimately I didn't really like it. So when I had the idea for Untersagen, I realized that the idea kind of outstripped my abilities, and I knew I needed time to change my drawing style and bring it back, bring some of the representational stuff back, but also just relearn a lot of other things that I had previously known. So this is an early, early version of what became the first part of Untersagen, and it ran in an anthology called Scheherazade that was published by Soft Skull. And one of the things I had to learn was storytelling economy, not making a moment last and last and last and last and go on and on and on and on, learning to compress the action more. I don't think that Yiddish stayed in there. Maybe I should change out that slide. And Minna's hair doesn't really look like that anymore either. This is the pre-Photoshop version of this page. Anyway, I was really interested as I started to work more on this book in learning to tell stories more economically. So I wanted to keep some of the excitement and the action, but make it more dynamic by compressing it. So I'm sorry, I'm moving rather quickly through these because I don't think there's any need to linger, but there we go. So talking about storytelling economy makes me want to tell you where I learned about storytelling economy. Now, I read a lot of books, I read a lot of fiction, and I read a lot of nonfiction, but I don't read to learn how to write. And I've never been good at learning how to write from the books that I read, because when I read for pleasure. I don't look for the seams. In fact, I'm not even sure I know how. So where I have learned good storytelling skills from is mostly film and really good episodic TV writing, which we're lucky to have some of right now. We were talking about Mad Men before. There should totally be a picture of Don Draper up here because that's some of the best writing I've ever seen. At any rate, here on the right are a bunch of stills from the film Volver by Pedro Almodovar, who is and was my storytelling idol for many years. When I'm working, I often ask myself, what would Pedro Almodovar do? Not because I want to imitate him, because no one can, but because I want to use him as a model for economy, for editing, for taking a lot of passion and compressing it and editing it so that he maintains this very fragile balance of passion and subtlety. He never bangs you over the head with it, unless it's literal, like I forget the title of the film where the woman kills somebody. She kills her husband with a frozen leg of ham, right? Is that What Have I Done to Deserve This? And then she cooks the ham so the cops don't find the evidence. Anyway, that's beside the point. I also learned a lot from a film that you see up on the upper right called Head On by Fatih Akin. It's a German-Turkish film that became my school of storytelling. I would watch it like 4 or 5 times a year. And that image on the bottom is from Deadwood, another very good piece of episodic writing with a lot of good scenes in a brothel. I learned a lot about brothels writing this book. But you can also learn from bad writing. Does anybody recognize what this is a still from? Yeah. So, okay, I know a lot of people really like Rome. I have a friend who's an art historian who specializes in Greco-Roman antiquities, and she loves it. But I came up with my storytelling motto watching this show, and in fact, it was watching this scene. So, 2 centurions on horseback, they stop at a river. One says to the other one, what's that river over there? The other guy replies, oh, that's the Rubicon. We're about to cross it. And I think I jumped up off the couch and yelled, they're shooting the outline. So that led me to my favorite storytelling phrase, which is don't shoot the outline. Make sure you're not shooting the outline. So here's an example of not shooting the outline. Just tell me if we're running out of time. I don't know if I'm going too slowly. We're okay? All right. So the scene on the right is the scene where it becomes clear that one of the girls is working in the brothel. And how does her mother find out? Well, so I had this discussion with my husband, and the part of that page that has the big X on it is my husband's notes. I was like, no, that's shooting the outline. So you start with the most obvious idea, right? And then you move on to something slightly less obvious, and then hopefully you get to something that's the most subtle economical version you can get to. So in the first panel, the guy walks in and he sees her. In the second panel, it's obvious he's already told someone. He's told the neighborhood gossip. You don't see what's happening in between. You don't even see the moment where he says, oh, guess who I saw at the brothel today? Because the guy would never say that. So the fact that it's obvious he's told her, but not how, and now they're having the sort of aftermath of that conversation, leads you to ask a lot of questions. Well, you know, this guy's pretty hypocritical. It puts a lot of subtext in there, which is important when you're telling a visual story. I'm going to pass over those because I don't think those are really necessary to talk about. So now I'd like to call up Josephine, who's going to read this scene with me. Can I swear in a library? Is that okay? Okay. Just quietly? Okay. And one and two. Girls, eyes up, up to the sky. Dreamier, you're supposed to be fairies for fuck's sake, not washerwomen. Again, arms up, float up like honeybees. Take a rest, you're making me seasick. Oh, good, you're here. You'll need some practice clothing, but for now your skivvies will do.
What the hell is she doing here? Doesn't she have some puke to clean up? Love the underthings. Is that what they're wearing in Paris now?
Good, Esther. Fly. Fly upwards. Yes, Esther. Beautiful.
Here, Edna. My practice things need a good wash.
Flutter. Flutter, goddammit.
That nose of yours sure is special, honey. It'll take you far, Edna.
Esther.
I'm serious, Ethner. You could open your own house for that nose alone.
Knock it off, Lynn. Esther's too young for that talk. Quit razzing her.
Hey, just trying to help. With a honker like that, she'll be a charity case unless a kind soul like me lends a hand.
Don't let her get to you, kid. She has the manners of a water rat.
It's okay. Now, what's that over there?
Oh, no, you don't. That one don't even have tits yet, you old hound.
Arf. That's you. Tell me more from Papa's book.
Where were we? Oh, yeah. He had to talk to his dead friends, because only they knew what to do. So he went to the doorway of the underworld, and he killed a sheep and poured its blood on the ground. His dead best friend and his dead mom and all these other dead people smelled the blood and came to drink it.
The ghosts drank blood?
Yeah, that's what they eat. So he talked to the ghosts until Persephone, the queen of the dead, came and told them to leave.
Good night, Essie.
Yep. The end. There will not be a quiz. Thank you very much, Josephine. And I'm not sure what to do with this.
Okay. Lovely to be here again. I didn't realize it would take me quite this long. From 2004 to 2012. So thank you to Andy and to the Free Library to have me back. I'll talk briefly and read from The Free World, which is a novel about a different family of Jews at a different point in time, but of similar origins. So the book is set in 1978. It's about a family of Soviet Jews, Latvian Jews, who leave the Soviet Union, and they're on their way. They're actually not quite sure to where, somewhere in North America, and they have to decide, and they make that decision in Italy. The book is set in Rome. So there was just to give you a little bit of context, there was a period when the only people, roughly speaking, the only people who could leave the Soviet Union, which was a place that you couldn't leave casually, were Jews who were supposed to go to Israel. You'd get an invitation, then you were supposed to go to Israel. And increasingly, people said, well, I'd prefer not to go to Israel. and I'd like to try my luck somewhere else. And so those people would then declare refugee status and start applying mostly to North America, the United States and Canada. So for a long time, until the fall of the Soviet Union, the Jewish, the Russian communities that you had in this country and still have are a consequence of this journey that I'm going to describe. So if you've been to Brighton Beach, a famous Russian Jewish community in Brooklyn, that came into existence because of this this sort of journey. So I'll read to you two different sections. As I say, it's a family traveling together. There are three generations of them, and it's told in three different voices. You'll hear from Alec, who's the youngest son. I'll read you the opening of the book so you'll get a sense of the family. And then I'll read from his father, Samuel, who you'll get a sense of as well. Okay. Alec Krasnansky stood on the platform of Vienna's southern terminal while all around him the representatives of Soviet Jewry from Tallinn to Tashkent roiled, snarled, and elbowed to deposit their belongings onto the waiting train. His own family roiled among them, his parents, his wife, his nephews, his sister-in-law, and particularly his brother Carl, worked furiously with the suitcases and duffel bags. He should have been helping them, but his attention was drawn farther down the platform by two pretty tourists. One was a brunette, Mediterranean and voluptuous, the other petite and blonde. In combination, they attested, as though by design, to the scope of the world's beauty and plenitude. Both girls were barefoot, their leather sandals arranged in tidy pairs beside them. Alec traced a line of smooth, tanned skin from heel to calf to thigh, interrupted ultimately by the frayed edge of cut-off blue jeans. Above the cut-off jeans, the girls wore thin sleeveless shirts. They sat on their backpacks and leaned casually against each other. Their faces were lovely and vacant. They seemed beyond train schedules and obligations. People sped past them. The Russian circus performed its ludicrous act several meters away, but they paid no attention. Alec assumed they were Americans. He guessed they were in their 20s. He was 26, but he could pass for younger. In school and university, he'd run track, and he'd retained a trim runner's build. He also had his father's dark, wavy hair. From the time Alec was a boy, he had been aware of his effect on women. In his presence, they often became exaggerated versions of themselves. The maternal ones became more maternal. The crude ones became cruder. The shy ones, shyer. They wanted only that he not make them feel foolish and were grateful when he didn't. In his experience, much of what was good in life could be traced to a woman's gratitude. Looking at the two girls, Alec had to resist the urge to approach them. It could be the simplest thing in the world. He had studied English. He needed only to walk over and say, "Hello, are you Americans?" And they needed only to respond, "Yes." "Where in America do you live?" "Chicago. And where are you from?" "Riga, Latvia, the Soviet Union." "How interesting. We have never met anyone from the Soviet Union before. Where are you traveling to?" "Chicago." "No. Is this true?" "Yes, it is true. I am traveling to Chicago." "Will this be your first time in Chicago?" "Yes, it will be my first time in Chicago. Can you tell me about Chicago?" "Yes, we can tell you about it. Please sit down with us. We will tell you everything about Chicago." "Thank you. You are welcome." Alec felt Carl's hand on his shoulder. "What's the matter with you?" "Nothing. We have 7 minutes to finish loading everything onto the waiting train." He followed Carl back to where their parents were arranging the suitcases so that Carl and Alec could continue forcing them through the window of the compartment. Near them, an elderly couple sat dejectedly on their bags. Others worked around them, avoiding not only helping them, but also looking them in the face. Old people sitting piteously on luggage had become a familiar spectacle. "I see them," Carl said. "Move your ass, and if there's time, we'll help them." Alec bent into the remaining pile of suitcases and duffel bags on the platform. Each seemed heavier than the last. For six adults, they had 20 articles of luggage crammed with goods destined for the bazaars of Rome. Linens, toys, samovars, ballet shoes, nesting dolls, leather Latvian handicrafts, nylon stockings, lacquer boxes, pocket knives, camera equipment, picture books, and opera glasses. One particularly heavy suitcase held Alex's big commercial investment, dozens of symphonic records. First hefting the bags onto his shoulder and then sliding them along the outside of the train, Alec managed to pass them up to the compartment into the arms of Paulina and Rosa, his and Carl's wives. Carl turned to the old couple. All right, citizens, can we offer you a hand? The old man rose from his suitcase, stood erect, and answered with the formality of a party official or university lecturer. We would be very obliged to you. If you will allow, my wife has with her a box of chocolates. It's not necessary. Not even a little something for the children. Carl's two boys had poked their heads out the compartment window. Do as you like, but they're like animals at the zoo. I suggest you mind your fingers. Alec and Carl shouldered the old people's suitcases and passed them into the compartment. Alec noticed the way the old man looked at Paulina. This is your wife. Yes. A true Russian beauty. I appreciate the compliment, though she might disagree. Emigration is not exactly cosmetic. Absolutely false. The Russian woman blossoms under toil. The Russian man can drink and fight, but our former country was built on the back of the Russian woman. What country wasn't? That may be so, but I don't know about other countries. I was a Soviet citizen. To my generation, this meant something. We sacrificed our youth, our most productive years, our faith. And in the end, they robbed us of everything. This is why it does my heart proud to see your wife. Every Jew should have taken with him a Russian bride, if only to deny them to the alcoholics. I'm an old man, but if the law had allowed, I would have taken 10 wives myself, real Russian women, because that country couldn't survive 5 minutes without them. The old man's wife, the incontrovertible product of shtetl breeding, listened to her husband's speech with spousal indifference. There was nothing, her expression declared, that she hadn't heard him say 100 times. To women, Alec said, when we get to Rome, we should drink to it. Alec helped the old couple onto the car and scrambled up as it began to edge forward. He squeezed past people in the narrow passageway and found his family, crammed in with their belongings. Perched on the pile of duffel bags, his father frowned in Alec's direction. What were you talking about with that old rooster? The greatness of the Russian woman. Your favorite subject. You almost missed the train. Samuel Krasnansky turned his head and considered their circumstances. The compartments are half the size. This was true, Alec thought. Say what you want about the Soviet Union, but the sleeping compartments were bigger. You want to go back because of the bigger compartments? Carl asked. What do you care about what I want? Samuel said. Samuel Krasnansky said nothing else between Vienna and Rome. He sat in silence beside his wife and eventually fell asleep. So that's how it begins. You've met the family. And I'll read a Samuel section and preface it by saying I think you've gotten the sense that he's not happy to be on this trip. You'll get a little of his history now, too. And to tell you just slightly why I wrote this book in the first place, in part, well, in general terms, it's because I don't think this story of these Soviet Jews in general is well known. The story of this emigration I don't think is well known. But there's also a certain character who is represented by Samuel that I think is, if people like that were once known, I think they've been largely forgotten. True believer socialists, communists, as they once existed, and the sort of people who made the revolution, who built up the Soviet Union. Some of them were Jews. And the question is, you know, what made people like that? And those people are gone, and the world that created them is gone, and it'll never be replicated. And having known people like that, considering myself, you know, one of the last living links to them, I felt kind of a deep sense of obligation to leave a document as best as I know how. That's true for, you know, this entire family and this emigration, but I think it's even more so true for people like Samuel. So you'll get a sense of him now. So I'm going to start not exactly at the beginning of this chapter. All you need to know is that Samuel, his wife Emma, and a good friend of his, a man his age, have gone to a club, kind of a social club. They're in Ladispoli, which is a seaside town outside of Rome, where a lot of these emigres, transmigrants, lived waiting for some country to accept them. Okay, so they've gone to the social club. There's a concert. The evening had been advertised to appeal to people of their generation, and some two dozen had come. Couples like him and Emma, single men like Roydman, and widows who arrived in the company of other widows. Scattered among them were younger people, though not very many. The friends and families of the musicians, Samuel supposed. Of the older people, few remained seated for long, but reported purposefully to the dance floor. Samuel did his obligatory turn with Emma, taking some pleasure in executing the steps. Around them, other couples danced as they did, cohesively, in marked contrast to the modern trend, where all thrashed about like epileptics, and it was uncertain who was dancing with whom. Was it any wonder, with such culture, that his sons had taken the wrong path? But what did it matter in the end, he thought, as he danced with Emma, surrounded by their dwindling cohort, who danced the steps from memory and nursed the infirmities of old age. They were all obsolete, a traveling museum exhibit of a lost kind, Stalin's Jews, unlikely survivors of repeat appointments with death. And if he allowed himself to feel any kinship with these people, what was the good of it? It was a kinship with the past, and a kinship with the past was no kinship for a revolutionary. A revolutionary allied himself only with the future, but as it sickened him to even think about the future, his revolutionary days were over. Samuel sat down when the band began to play Where Are You, My Garden? Roydman had requested the honor and was now hobbling with Emma on the dance floor, one arm around Emma, the other on his crutch. When they returned from the dance floor, Emma and Roydman were joined by the rabbi. Samuel had noticed a man circulating around the room, approaching guests or being approached. People more than twice his age, people who should have known better, took his hand reverentially and drew him near to mouth a joke or a confidence, which the rabbi received with the lofty humility of a sage. A Soviet education, the war, and decades of Soviet life, and still the kernel of religious servility hadn't been eradicated. It had lain dormant like a suppressed vice, a prejudice or superstition, waiting for an opportune moment to resurface. Now the moment had come, personified by this man with the pale, thin wrists and patchy beard, purveyor of discount chicken. Emma led the rabbi to the table. Here was the generous rabbi who had shown such kindness to their grandchildren. He was a gem of a man and a holy person. Every Jew is holy before God, the rabbi said to Emma's approbation. Rabbi, I'm not a believer, Samuel said. This sort of talk doesn't interest me. I understand, the rabbi said. Your wife has told me you're not a believer, but you are still a Jew. You carry within you the holy spark. These terms are meaningless to me. I would never speak like this about my origins. But are these not your origins? You're interested in an account of my origins, if you wish to tell me. I was born in 1913 in the town of Rogozna in the Kiev region. My father managed the woods and owned a general store. I am Jewish by nationality. I did not complete my higher education. When I was 6 years old, my father was murdered by the whites. After his death, my mother became a seamstress and remained a member of the proletariat until her death at the hands of the German fascists. At the age of 14, I was trained by my uncle as a bookbinder. I worked at this trade until the war. At age 16, I was a member of a communist cell. In 1940, when the Latvian SSR was established, I joined the party. During the war, I volunteered for the front and rose to the rank of captain in the Red Army. After demobilization, I was finance director of the VEF radio technical factory, until 6 months ago. I was a member in good standing of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. I was never expelled from the party and never had any party penalties assessed. I have the following awards: Order of the Red Star, Order of the Red Banner, Medal for Bravery, and Medal for Victory over Germany in the Great Patriotic War, 1941 to 1945. You will notice that I make no mention of any spark, soul, or God. Soma, don't get upset, Emma said. The rabbi means well. He means what he means, Samuel replied, and I mean what I mean. Your husband is right, the rabbi said. It's a shame that we mean different things, but I respect your husband as a man of his convictions. Samuel Lazarevich, if you had applied the strength of your convictions to the Torah, I don't doubt that you could have been a great rabbi today. Nonsense. Had I applied myself to your Torah, I would not be here today. The NKVD would have put me on a train or the Germans in a pit. All the more reason to return now to the Torah, wouldn't you say, out of respect for our martyrs? There are many kinds of martyrs. You honor yours, I'll honor mine. Samuel excused himself and went outside. The rabbi had switched topics and begun to speak about Israel and the peace negotiations with Egypt. He spouted drivel about the Age of Redemption. For the first time since the destruction of the Second Temple, the Jews were once again masters over Greater Israel, the portion that the Almighty had promised Abraham. All of this portended the imminent arrival of the Messiah. Thus, it was absolutely forbidden for Begin to surrender any of the sacred land to the Arabs, God's covenant inherited in every stone and every shrub. Outside Club Kadima, Samuel walked away from the building and leaned against a low wrought iron fence. The security guard, a beefy, middle-aged emigre, tossed a casual remark about the humidity inside the club. Samuel didn't bother to reply. He rested his hip against the fence and waited for the coolness and quiet to act upon his thoughts. The rabbi's remarks had agitated him too much and caused his blood pressure to spike. He'd become flushed and lightheaded, and he'd noticed Emma appraising him. He felt a tremendous urgency to get free of them both. Alone in the street, he calmed down. The talk of religion, martyrs, and Begin led him to think of his cousin. You would need to know earlier in the book, he has a cousin who's a Zionist who gets taken away. Begin was in America meeting with Carter and the Egyptian Sadat. The entire civilized world attended his every move, but who was Begin? A simple Jew from Brest, a Beitar activist and a disciple of Jabotinsky. Like Yankel, he'd been deported to Siberia in the summer of 41. A year later, he was pardoned and allowed to join the Polish army. It was possible that Yankel had met with a similar fate. And so it was possible that he'd survived the war and found his way to Palestine. His biography up to a point was sufficiently similar to Begin's or to those of many of the other Israeli leaders of the same generation. Ordinary Jewish activists like him had founded their country and were now international statesmen. Samuel recalled his cousin's words from the final night. He had bet on one horse, while Samuel and Reuven, Samuel's brother, had bet on another. That night it had seemed that Yankel's horse had lost. Nearly 40 years later, this was no longer so. Now it seemed instead that Yankel had prematurely conceded the race. But the race continued. The horses went around and around the track indefinitely, switching places. The race was never lost or won. All that happened was that, in the interim, men died. The trick was to die at the right moment, consoled by the perception of victory. More likely than not, Yankel had died too soon. As for himself, Samuel thought, he would die too late. Thank you.
Stage change, and we're off to the Q&A. Who would like to start us off with a question? All the way down in front here, we've got a question. Yeah, sir, Mike is coming. It's right behind you.
Well, thanks both of you for coming. I'm just astounded, David, by your ability to get into the mind of somebody who's two generations older than you, whose life is so different from yours, and who experienced all these things. I'm just interested in the writing process, how you learn what Samuel was thinking and feeling, and how his reactions to all these things took place. How do you find that?
Sure. Well, I think that question would apply to both of us, since we're writing from the perspective of people who are two, three generations removed. My short answer is it's two things. One is growing up in an environment where I was exposed to some people like this. Not necessarily, you know, specifically like him, deeply ideologically this way. But that's part of it. And doing some research, reading as much as I could about men of that generation. But I think one writes about people with whom you have some kind of sympathy, kind of. I'm sympathetic to Samuel in a way, even though some of what he does, chooses to do, is morally, repugnant. But it's a function of the time. I guess the only thing I can say is, I think I was born kind of an old person to begin with. It's much easier for me to write old people. I was kind of an old man. It's easier for me to identify with old people. I think about death a lot. I don't know how else to explain it. But writing Samuel, oddly, was the easiest of all of them for me to do. I enjoy the company of older people. And maybe even at this stage of my life and probably, you know, for a while, I've kind of been looking at life as if I'm much closer to the end of it than I hope I actually am. But I think that's part of it too. And what I was mentioning before, this sense of sadness, I can't describe it any other way, for a generation of people who I knew and felt love for. And I'm speaking about a generation broadly, obviously. But there was something about their mentality and their temperament and their history, what they went through, that affected me. And so, you know, in writing about them, it was very important for me to try to get it right.
Is that something you can follow up on, Lila, with regard to your characters, particularly the mother?
Well, first, actually, I want to kind of continue something David was saying, which is, well, I don't know if it's a continuation of what you're saying. Actually, it's not really. But when you write fiction, you have to get into the head of a lot of different people. And many of those characters will be very different from you. But human nature doesn't really change. I'm not going to spoil David's book, but I know what transpired between Samuel and Yankel, and it's very profound. Also very... Am I remembering that correctly? It's been a few months since I read the book. But I feel like there are odd, miraculous things that happen when you write fiction. And I'm sorry if that sounds foofy. characters begin to take off on their own, and very intense situations play out between them. I'm calling them characters, and I'm being very careful because I have to stress that characters aren't people. As to my parentage, what did you want to ask me about the mother?
Well, just David was talking about how he had a familiarity and a responsibility, he thought, with some of these folks to talk about that generation. And you are obviously removed by three generations from the mother you portray. So maybe you could talk about some of the memories that infuse that.
Well, actually, the mother in this book is, she was one of the most difficult characters to write, and possibly one of the least successful, I think. She wasn't that important to me. She's nothing like my mother. She's not really like anybody in my family, except for the line about dancing is for shiksas and gypsies, which is what my grandmother said to my mother in, I don't know, 1965 in the Bronx when my mother was invited to take a company class at American Ballet Theater, and my grandmother locked her in the house after saying that. It was her fancy way of saying no. So the mother is maybe not the best example for me, but I had to get into the head of their father a lot, and that, because I was thinking a lot about my grandfather, I was taking a lot of liberties with those thoughts of my grandfather too. But I honestly don't think that it's very, I think it's just part of the process of creating fiction, wouldn't you say?
I think it is, though. As I guess the one thing I should also add about somebody like Samuel, in the way that he's very different from me, is this commitment to an ideology, and how that makes you think, and coming to try to understand what somebody's thought process is who believes very strongly in that type of ideology, and continues to believe it in spite of mounting evidence to the contrary. And I think we, you know, my family moved to Canada. Canada is a less, I think, polemical place in a way than America. I think that makes more sense here where, you know, there are stronger allegiances ideologically, even though we're still talking about a narrower subset. So either you're Republican or you're Democrat here. And people are very committed to that in a way that in Canada we don't have quite the same way. But it's still...
You're lucky.
Well, but, you know, it makes it interesting, though, what no longer exists is a real left. I mean, there is no real left in the way that there used to be. There's also, I would argue, despite what some people would say, not a real fascist right in the same way. But there's definitely not a real left in the way that there used to be, in an organized way, and how people thought when they were truly committed on the left. And trying to get into the head of somebody like that, that took some work.
I wonder if there are a lot of Samuels wandering around Brighton Beach. I used to spend a lot of time in Brighton Beach. I worked in that community for a long time.
I think not quite Samuels, but that mentality, the Soviet mentality for people of a certain generation, some aspects of it remain. I think this idea of, this is a really paradoxical idea, of people who suffered tremendously under the Soviet system and at the same time internalized some of this ideas of having a very strong leader. I think Russians still... in general, like this idea of a strong leader and showing strength despite what it did to their country and the Soviet Union.
Another question. Yeah, Connie.
This is for David. I'm unhampered by fact because I haven't read the book yet. But I'm a little frustrated because I'm very intimately aware of what was going on in the Soviet Union during those years. And I would love to know what this family experienced before they came out. Were they ever in refusal? What was the anti-Semitism like for them? Was there ever... any kind of dispute as to whether they should go, some in the family wanted to go to Israel or some wanted didn't want to go to Israel. I would like to know.
Well, fortunately, many of those answers will be answered in the book. One thing I will say about it, I think the story that's known to people in America about the whole Soviet Jewry thing is one of refuseniks, right? Of people who battled, you know, because of a deep sense of frustration with the Soviet system, but also a desire to often go to Israel, right? And those are the people you heard about, the Sharanskys and people like that. They were the small, heroic minority. The larger, you know, common majority were people like this family, people who, to lesser or greater degrees, suffered from anti-Semitism, though anti-Semitism was systemic, and so everybody suffered to one degree or another. You knew you couldn't apply to this university. You'd never get in. That job was closed to you. You knew you couldn't, you know, travel abroad in the way that other people could. So those things were systemic. But I think for the most part, and people kind of managed somehow, it wasn't Nazi Germany. Okay? And especially when we're talking about this era, the 70s was not even Stalinist, 40s and 50s. So people were getting out, I think, mostly by this point because they saw a very limited future for them, for their children. And they saw an opportunity to, have a better life. And they didn't know how long that opportunity would continue. It was difficult to get out. And this book is written about, deliberately. There's a wonderful book called When They Come For Us, We'll Be Gone by Gal Beckerman that talks about the heroic minority. Great book. Can't recommend it highly enough. But this is about, people like the people I knew, people like my family, who were not great heroes. I mean, what they undertook, even not being heroes, was a very arduous and dramatic journey. One that, if you were to tell me, you do what your parents did, right? I'm 38 years old, about to turn 39. I have two children. One is 4 and one is 1, okay? And my wife. If you were to tell me, leave America, Canada now, with nothing, okay, and go to, let's pick some country that's as foreign can be to me. I don't know what that would be. Korea, okay? You don't speak the language. You don't know anybody there. You don't know anything. You can't tell one city from another. Go do that. I don't know, if I was forced to, I guess I would. And what's fascinating about that period in the Soviet Union is that it wasn't a war. It wasn't, pogroms. It was this phenomenon called just bad enough. It was a fascinating phenomenon, just bad enough. When things are just bad enough that you're willing to uproot yourself. So that's what the book chronicles, but also it goes back in history and it tells, the story of the Soviet century and more specifically the Soviet Jewish century.
Final question before we end the evening. Yes, lady all the way in back.
Hi. David, you had mentioned that you are writing for, that you're particularly interested in sharing the story of the Soviet immigration and that it's a story that you don't think a lot of people are familiar with. I'm the child of Soviet Jewish immigrants, came to the U.S. when I was 2 years old, and I naturally gravitate towards these stories, and I think that that has, for me, a lot to do with my own background. A question for you both. Can you speak a little bit about your ideal reader and to what extent your ideal reader is someone who has some sort of cultural affinity with the stories that you're telling and to what extent you think about an ideal reader at all? How would you describe such a person?
You care to go first?
Sure. That's an interesting question. I've never thought about that. I don't have an ideal reader off the top of my head, but I guess if I had to think about it, I would say my ideal reader is someone who understands that there are a lot of applications for visual storytelling, and this is one of them, who takes it seriously as a medium. I write for adults who can put two and two together, so I don't spoon feed the story to people. So my ideal reader is somebody who can ride with that, I guess. I hope that answers that question. I like it when people get my cultural references that I throw in there, but I don't expect them to get them all. And some of them are like little Easter eggs also.
I guess I'd say that my ideal reader is the person who enjoys the writers that I enjoy. So, you know, if I can name contemporary writers that I enjoy reading, if people read those people who don't necessarily have to be, you know, Jewish or Soviet or anything, that sort of reader. You know, I'm a big fan of J.M. Coetzee, who writes differently than me. But whoever reads Coetzee, I hope that they'll come and, you know, and be able to read my books. Eugenides, somebody I like a lot. I see no reason why somebody who reads Middlesex shouldn't read this book. And it's not a cultural thing. It has much more to do with literature. I say that being aware that I think we all have our affinities, and often our affinities relate to where we come from. So I think for people who are close to this experience, intimately closer, it's like concentric circles, right? For them, they'll be closer in. But you throw a pebble in, you have these concentric circles, and other people who, you know, don't have quite as much familiarity would still be able to get something out of it. But ultimately, I think, you know, anybody who likes literature of the type that I like, I hope will like this. And I don't delude myself to think that people who read books very different from mine and different from the books that I aspire to write are going to like this. But when I write really with one thing in mind, kind of like the most important thing is, don't be boring. Okay?
Yeah.
So I just try not to be boring. But my standard of what is boring, I understand, is not everybody's standard. And so I accept that and hope that the people who are, you know, who appreciate the sort of thing that I generally appreciate will come to this work and like it and get out of it what I've put into it.
I want to say that I really enjoyed your book, and my family also came from a similar background, similar part of Europe, but earlier. So to me, it was really interesting as a child of earlier immigrants to read about this generation. And I'm happy that you and a lot of other writers are starting to explore that. Because also growing up in New York City and living in Brooklyn, in South Brooklyn, for a really long time, I just left Flatbush. It is full of post-Soviet Jews and other FSU people, and it's seeing them reflected in fiction is really interesting. And also, I sort of felt like Samuel was the mirror opposite of my grandfather Mendel, who bought his way out of the Red Army with two bottles of black market vodka. He went to the commanding officer of, I guess, the regiment that had liberated his part of Poland, and said, "I have a baby girl. I want to live in the American zone. Oh, and I have these bottles of vodka." He was running black market operations over the Czech border for a few months after the war. Mm-hmm. So he had access to this stuff. And he hated the communists.
Sure.
Hated them.
My grandfather was a Zionist. I mean, my actual grandfather that I was close to hated the communists. He was a Zionist, wanted to live in Israel. That's a different story. But he wouldn't have worked in this book because he would have just said, "I'm going to Israel. See the rest
no
of you
story.
Later." He's gone. So I needed somebody who stuck around and somebody who also embodied this, you know, this Soviet communist thing that was fascinating to me, but in a way that was earnest, not in a way that people were forced to kind of parrot when they didn't believe it and couldn't wait to be free of it.
His disappointment makes him a very interesting character.
He's a true believer, and I think I'm fascinated by people who are true believers. And I think we're fortunate to live in a place where we don't have to really be true believers in the same way. We have the luxury. Mm-hmm. We can choose. You can choose
That's
to be whatever
true.
You want. You can believe whatever you want. I can be a Buddhist tomorrow and nobody will tell me, don't be a Buddhist.
And nobody's holding a gun to your head.
Yeah. But what does it mean to ally yourself with an idea and an ideal and sacrifice for it? And in Samuel's case, sacrifice others for it. And then come to a point in your life where your children have rejected it and, consider
and
it ridiculous.
It's
rejected them. And there you are. And what are you supposed to think? What are you supposed to feel? And if you repudiate this ideology, you're basically repudiating your entire life.
Well, I want to thank all the true believers who came out this evening. Please join me in thanking Leela Korman and David Bismos.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.